Dear friends, a very warm welcome to all of you for today's short talk on the subject analogy and correspondence. Those of us who have studied the ancient scriptures and come in touch with theosophy would be invariably exposed to analogy and correspondence. We may not know that this is what it is, but we would have been exposed to the methods of analogy and correspondence. Let's see what the definition of analogy and the definition of correspondence is. Analogy is defined as the process of transferring meaning or information from one particular subject to another. A similarity between the like features of two things on which a comparison may be made. So it is likeness, resemblance, similitude. Correspondence also is similar, comes very close to analogy, but yet there is a subtle difference. Correspondence is defined as agreement and connection between two or more things. Conformity of one thing with another. So it comes very close to analogy, but yes, there is a subtle difference. It speaks of connection between two things, two or more things. Now, in the modern science and methods, analogy is not used as a means for acquiring knowledge. It is rather used as a means for teaching or communication of ideas. At least that's what the student understands. But among the ancients, analogy played a very vital role in its epistemology. Great stress was laid upon this law of analogy and correspondence. Analogy and correspondence is not something merely man-made thing, concept, but it's a law in nature. That's what the ancient said. You see the tablets of Hermes Trismegistus in the Hermetic writings, this is very strongly put forward in the famous statement, which says, as above, so below. Man is the microcosm of the macrocosm. The statement, the Hermetic statement goes like this: that which is below corresponds to that which is above, and that which is above corresponds to that which is below. To occur the miracle of the one thing, a similar idea is what St. Paul is said to have mentioned when he said, this world is an enigmatic mirror of pure truth. In the secret doctrine, this idea is very strongly brought forward, and a very important statement is made, just a few lines. I'll read this and then we will come back. This is a law in occult sciences. This is an observation and a record of how the nature works in reality. Axioms are given, and one of them says, the universe is worked and guided from within. As above, so it is below, as in heaven, so on earth. And the man, the microcosm and miniature copy of the macrocosm, is a living witness to this universal law and to the mode of its action. How is it? How is man the living example of this, workings of this law? Explanation is given. It says, we see that every external motion, act, gesture, whether voluntary or mechanical, organic or mental, is produced and preceded by internal feeling or emotion, will or volition, thought or mind, emotion or feeling, will or volition, thought or mind. Combination of these three are certainly there and precede internal activity, motion. So there is always something within and that is expressed outwardly, right? As no outward motion or change when normal in man's external body can take place unless provoked by an inward impulse given through one of the three functions named, so with the external or manifested universe, what happens in man, the same process you can find in the whole of the cosmos. Why? Because the functions of man, the nature of man is similar to the function and the natures of universe. The whole cosmos is guided and controlled and animated by almost endless series of hierarchies of sentient beings, each having a mission to perform, and who, whether we give them one name or another and call them Dhyan Chauhans or angels, are messengers in the sense only that they are the agents of karmic and cosmic law. Take the human body, just the physical frame. How many different kinds of hierarchies of intelligence you find in the body? Each organ specialized to do a particular function, composed of smaller army of its own, which work incessantly to do these, whether man is conscious or not, digestion takes place, respiration takes place. Similarly, the whole frame is filled with hierarchies of intelligences, right? Similarly, the way with the cosmos. So anything that happens in the external world is actually a reflection and a representation of what is happening in the inner world. And a great sage, a great being like Vyasa can take an account, historical, historical
event,
and see in this historical event the pattern, the cosmic pattern. Mahabharata, historical event, but a Vyasa can see in this historical event and draw from these lessons such that the whole Mahabharata becomes allegorical. In the sense, it is story, but in that story each character represents something, symbolizes something. Each event that happens there represents some relationship, some process. So one who knows how to decipher, use the right key to unlock these symbols, can obtain knowledge from it. So the Puranas, the Zohar, the Mahabharata, Ramayana, the epics, and the Zoroastrian story that we heard a couple of Sundays ago, how Ormuzd and Ahriman were born from the same womb, all these are actually symbolical representations which contain rich knowledge for one who knows how to decipher it. So the first thing that we have to do is disabuse our mind from these wrong notions, wrong thinking, which says that ancients were all fools, ancients were all superstitious, there was no science among ancients. Science only started a few hundred years ago in the West. That is not the case. We should disabuse, we should remove those ideas from our mind. Because the ancients had a science which is far more comprehensive, far more, it goes deep into the very heart of matter, into the very root of nature,
and records there what is the reality. While the physical science examines the modern science examines the physical matter, the ancient science says there are various other grades of matter which can be as scientifically and more scientifically examined through instruments developed and perfected. So this we must keep in mind. For the modern science, knowledge comes through the senses, because the idea is that there is an objective reality which exists out there, and the contact with objective reality is through senses. So senses are the channels of knowledge, empirical method. So you proceed from analyzing the many varied phenomena and try to reach principles or universal laws. What is mind then? What is the mind? Does mind have any role to play in this? It doesn't seem to be, except for ratiocination and use of logic. Other functions of mind does not seem to have any, give rise to any knowledge in the modern scientific method, because mind is an outcome of biochemical reactions, molecular actions. Therefore, in order to understand what is reality, they study the molecules, molecular connections, the genes. Again, the reductionist method is used. That is, the whole world can be reduced to constituent parts. Each of those parts can be further reduced. So try to go to the least or the most fundamental particles and understand them, and you will be able to understand the whole. The whole does not have any subsistence or any existence apart from its constituent parts. Right? These are some ideas just to understand how modern science, parts of modern science works. But among the ancients, it was completely reversed. They rejected the sense data, the data obtained from the senses. But we must ask why. Some of the reasons is very easily understandable if we study the scriptures. The physical senses give you knowledge which is very narrow. A small slice of the entire reality, a small slice of that is presented, and it is presented as if it is the whole. So that is one issue with the sense data. And the other is the untrained mind, and which is moved by desires and prejudices and bias, will always color your sense data, sense information, and then distort it. So the example, just to use an analogy in this talk of analogy and correspondence, is if a scientist gets to know that the microscope that he is using or the telescope that the astronomer is using is presenting only partial view, which is distorted by the lens and colored and made such that what he is seeing is colored and distorted, then what will he say about that instrument? He will say, reject that instrument is imperfect, unscientific. Similarly, the case with the senses. That's why the ancient scientists, sages, rejected the sense data. So, now coming to analogy. Analogy is a very important law which has to be understood in our study of ancient science, analogy and correspondence. This analogy, you find it when you study any of the ancient philosophies actually. You take the Indian system just as an example, we were discussing it yesterday, right? They said there are six means of acquiring knowledge. Prama is knowledge. Pramana means the means or the instruments of acquiring knowledge. The first of the six means, analogy was an integral part. Just to recount what the other five are, there was pratyaksha pramana, that is direct perception, whether through direct perception basically, pratyaksha pramana. Next is anumana, not the Kannada anumana which means suspicion. Anumana in Sanskrit means inference, logical inference, that is of acquiring knowledge. Third was upamana, which is analogy, comparison. Fourth is shabda, shabda pramana, which means the ancient sages who looked into the reality and recorded the soul of things, and their record is the holy scriptures when read in the right sense, right? That is shabda pramana, fourth one. And the fifth one was arthapatti, and the sixth one was anupalabdhi, which means non-apprehension. Let's not go into details of what they are, but the point which is being made here is upamana, comparison, analogy was a means of acquiring knowledge, not merely a means of teaching, means of acquiring knowledge. That is important to know. Let's take a few examples of analogy and correspondence and see how beautifully it illustrates and how beautifully the sages have used these systems to convey knowledge. Right? First is some examples about the nature of self. A very common example that we have come across is the analogy of the pot. Right? The pot. There is a space which is contained by the pot called ghatakasha, space within the ghata. And then there is the infinite space, mahakasha. So the question is asked, what is the difference between the space inside the pot and the infinite space that is outside? Actually, there is no difference. The pot only makes it appear as if the space within is separate from the space outside. This is used to the information, the knowledge that the individual self, individual consciousness, and its relationship with the universal consciousness. The only difference is the various vehicles, the various sheets which acts like ghata or the clay pot. Once you overcome the illusion of all these various instruments, then the reality is what it is always, which is that yourself and all the other selves are one. Another analogy is used. You take gold. You can make innumerable ornaments out of gold, earrings, nose rings, bangles, anything, different designs and so on. You may call it a bangle on the right hand of such and such a person, earring on the left ear of such and such a person and so on. You can give it innumerable forms and names. But the primary essence is that it is gold. Similarly, there are innumerable beings of different names and forms, but the names and forms are illusion in the ultimate analysis, and what is real is it is all made up of one essence. So the analogy of the gold, and this is also beautifully expressed when Krishna uses this method to teach Arjuna, where he says, as a single sun illuminates the whole world. How many beings are there? Innumerable beings, innumerable kinds. But there is only one sun which makes all of these come alive, right? Gives life to them. Similarly, there is one spirit which illumines everybody. And then there is the beautiful, very nice analogy of the clothes. The body is compared to the clothes that we wear. This is one of the first teachings that Krishna gives to Arjuna, who says, don't think you are this body. The body is like clothes that you wear. Why are you getting attached to your clothes and behaving as if you are this cloth? end of the day you remove the cloth because it's dirty and then wear new clothes the next day. Similarly is your body. Don't think you will die when death comes. You just remove these outer covering, the garments, and after a period of rest, you take up another body. So if you dwell upon this idea, this imagery that is presented in the scriptures, it gives you a certain kind of dispassion, vairagya. Non-attachment to body comes from dwelling upon this idea, upon the true nature of self and the illusion of all the outer coverings. Next is, though this is some things about the nature of self, right? Cyclic law, so nicely explained, if you only remember what we have studied. The analogy of sleeping and waking is so beautiful. You see, it's an evident fact, we all have periods of activity, periods of rest. This is an expression of the cyclic law which runs throughout the universe. Every day, in a cycle of day and night, we go through three stages, three phases or three planes of consciousness. First is the waking consciousness, what we are all in now. The end of the two, the dreaming state, the swapna. And finally, it is said that every one of us go and touch a very high state of spiritual consciousness called Sushupti, where the ego is free from the bondage of desires and bondage of matter. For a period we are take rest there, and then again the cycle starts. We come to Swapna, from Swapna to waking. So this cycle is corresponding to the cycle that happens after each life. The period of activity corresponding to this one day is corresponding to one life, let's say, from the cradle to the grave. But that's not, the grave is not the end of it. The garment given up. And then there is two other distinct states that we go into. Corresponding to Sushupti, there is something called Devachan, where all the unselfish, noble experiences that have been generated in this life is assimilated. How do we understand this assimilation? Use the law of analogy. You eat food. You eat it for a few minutes, 15-20 minutes. It takes 4 hours to digest, assimilate, make a part of one's being, right? Similarly, all the experiences that are generated in this life, the worthy experiences, the spiritual one, unselfish one, anything which comes closer to the nature of our true self, that is gathered, assimilated, made a part of our soul, our ego. And then, just like we wake up the next day and resume our work, so also we wake up in the next life. And if we have eaten bad food today, it affects us tomorrow also. It doesn't end today. Similarly, the actions that we have done here, good as well as bad, is carried forward to the next life. There is a continuity. So you see the system of analogy and correspondence. What you see in one day, in a cycle of 24 hours, is like one day and night of the ego, which is one life, death and the next life. And this gives us some hints about the karmic connections that we have, obligations that we have. If we have fought with someone today, But when we sleep and forget about it and wake up tomorrow, that doesn't mean the animosity has gone. It's still there, right? Similarly, the friends and the enemies that we make in this life, we will face them in the next life also as our helpers or as our detractors. So if you look at, if you take the same law and apply it retrospectively, the benefits, the good that we have in this life is a result of the good that has been done in the past. And similarly, the troubles and the problems that we are facing is self-made. This is what we can understand. So the ego is set, again another analogy is used. Ego is likened to a string without beginning and without end. Sutratman, on which innumerable beads are put. What are each of these beads? Each of these beads correspond to the analogy that is used is each of our life. How much worthiness of our life is, the worthiness of our life is proportionate to the unselfishness and the spiritual energies that we have generated during the life. So it's called Sutratman, and it's called the pilgrim soul. That is, the soul, a spark of the spirit, is going through the life of matter, going through the cycles of matter, clothing itself again and again. Cyclic law. So this journey is very nicely explained in the story of the prodigal son. We all know the story of prodigal son. Again, you take it as a story, an allegory, but hidden in that allegory is so much truth. It speaks of the evolution of the soul. He is a son, he is a prince actually. He loses his way, forgets about his father's kingdom, forgets that he is the heir to the kingdom, and goes and lives with the swines, with the pigs, in the pigsty, eats its food and behaves like pig. Then one day he remembers, no, this is not my life. My life is to be, I am an heir to the kingdom of my father. And then he wakes up and then retraces his step through long search, finds his father's kingdom and claims the throne. This is a story, but it speaks of evolution of the soul. We are all prodigal sons, heir to the kingdom of spirit, but lost our way in the world of matter and living as if we are this physical body and trying to enjoy this physical life, right? So our own experiences lead us to question this, because there's constant pain and suffering, and then seek knowledge which will lead us back to the Father's kingdom. So just an analogy again, just to illustrate this analogy and correspondence. And this father's place was the promised land, Jerusalem. Now Jerusalem, you see how the scripture has been completely misunderstood to mean a geographical piece of land, and people are fighting for it. The promised land, Jerusalem, was that, the kingdom of heaven. So right, reading the scriptures in its right sense yields its true meaning. Something about correspondence also. Those who have read Cosmogenesis as explained in Secret Doctrine will understand this better. It is said that there is spirit, there is matter. Spirit and matter are not independent realities, but two aspects of the one. And in the manifested universe, there is a link between spirit and matter, which is called as Fuhan, right? You take man, The same thing happens, as was given in the ST, before every external action which makes our body move, act, speak and so on, preceding to that is either emotion or will or thought that gets translated. There is a translation, process of translation that happens, and what is on the mental plane will convert itself into physical action. Same example you find, look, the example that is given is to show how the same law, the same pattern works in the greatest of the cosmic processes as well as the tiniest one. To take, we had actually discussed this, take the example of how the proteins are made in the cell. There is DNA which contains the plan. The DNA makes something called messenger RNA. This messenger RNA contains the genetic information. Similar to in the cosmic processes, Brahma or the hierarchy of intelligent beings impressing upon themselves or contain themselves the plan which exists in the universal mind. So the plan exists in DNA, then there is a messenger RNA which contains the genetic information. Now this messenger RNA is transferred or reaches ribosome, which does the actual work of generation of amino acid sequence, of protein products, of gene expressions. So ultimate work that is done by ribosome, the intelligence came from DNA. The same pattern you can see in the cosmic working also. If you have understood the first fundamental proposition, this makes thrilling, it is very thrilling to see this pattern. The highest, the cosmos itself, how it came into existence, and the simple act of amino acids through that protein expression that happens, you find this. What do you say to this? Another example is you find when we studied the fifth chapter of volume 2, Isis Unveiled, we studied the triple trinities, right? The 10 sephiroth are there, and then there is a triangle above it. You remember the diagram that we studied in the morning. There is the end sof, then there is the secondary triangle, then there is the seven. So you may call it the primary triangle, the secondary triangle, and then the seven. This same pattern you find among the nutrients that are required for biological life, plants. There are primary macronutrients corresponding to the primary triad that we, the primary triangle. The primary macronutrients are essential. These are NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, potash, right? Potassium. Then comes secondary macronutrients, which are three. There is a primary, which are three, corresponding to the triangle. Then the secondary, there are also three. They are, the secondary nutrients are calcium, magnesium and sulfur. Then comes the seven micronutrients. What do you say to this? The three and the seven. Don't you see the working of the same one law, one pattern? Seven micronutrients goes like this: boron, copper, iron, chloride, manganese, molybdenum, zinc, the seven. So there are seven micronutrients, the three secondary macronutrients, three primary macronutrients. Of course, beyond this, there is one more three which is mentioned, which is carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, which no human being can provide to the plant. It is existent in nature. No human being can intervene. Absolute abstract motion, absolute abstract space and duration, probably. So the more you study these universal laws, the more you can decipher that in its particular manifestation. So from universals to particulars, this is the deductive logic. It is not that inductive logic is neglected in the ancient system. But first necessary is understanding of the universal patterns, universal laws. Once that is understood, you can apply it mutatis mutandis to any processes in nature and understand. So, somewhere HPB says in the first volume of SD that the law in occultism is uniformity in diversity. The second law is law of analogy and correspondence, something to this effect. The law of analogy and correspondence that we are seeing, just one or two simple examples that we took now, wherein all the functions of nature, the processes of nature, the events of life reflects something that is inner, deeper and cosmic, right? How does this happen? Why does this happen? This happens because it is explained in the first law, which HPB says, which is uniformity in diversity. Unity in diversity. The ultimate thing, ultimate reality is all this is but one. All beings, all intelligences are but aspects of one. And the many laws that we see working, aspects of the one law, expressions of the one law. So here we see that DT, one, law, one, and being is one. So what we study in the first, second and third fundamental proposition actually is speaking of the same one from different angles. First, second, third fundamental speak of the same thing, same one from different angles. DT is law, is being. It is because the same law is working in the production and generation of the cosmos, the same law is working in the production and generation of the amino acid, of the protein, of the genetic expression. Therefore, you see the same pattern repeating itself again. So beautifully explained in the Kabbalistic system of the triple trinities. The first trinity, they have their plan, they take it, they execute everything, they transfer it, they do their work and transfer it to the next lower trinity, which is an emanation of themselves. What does the second trinity do? Second trinity follows the same plan, the same pattern, do their work and then transfer the responsibility below. The third trinity does the same thing. So the same being, the same law. So it's something which is so nice to read this, the more you study this. So among the ancients, this deductive logic was first used, where you proceed from universal established principles, like it happens in geometry. Two things, one of the Euclid's axioms says that two things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Now this axiom does not need any proof. It is self-evident. Similarly, in the ancient systems, these self-evident truths were comprehended, recorded and given to the students as Bija Sutras, seed thoughts, something that has to be worked upon and made a part of our thinking, and from that basis you reason. Then you are bound to reach what is truth, because your premises is based on solid foundation of truth. But on the other hand, if your premises is shaky, faulty, no matter how right your reasoning is, it will lead to wrong conclusions. Right? So, it appears that when we speak of analogy and correspondence, to this student understanding, please don't take it as truth or anything. This student understands the way that analogy speaks about magic as a science, acquirement of knowledge, and correspondence probably is more to do with magic as an art, that is application of this knowledge. Analogy more to do with science, acquirement of knowledge. Correspondence, not that you can't acquire knowledge through correspondence, law of correspondences, but more to do with application of that knowledge. One of the things, important thing that are mentioned is that this one being becomes seven. Each of those seven becomes seven, and so on and so forth, right? Which means that take any seven in nature, it corresponds to seven in everything else in nature. There are seven principles in man. There are seven cosmic forces, hierarchies of beings. The principles of man, it is said, each of them are derived from one of the seven hierarchies. There are seven colors, seven sounds, seven principles. Take any seven, there will be correspondence between them. And this knowledge of purifying and controlling the seven in man and working upon them will result in operation on those cosmic forces which are headed by those hierarchies. This is such an awful science, which is why it was said in the Delphic Oracle, man, know yourself. If you know yourself in reality, in completeness, you know the whole universe. You control the whole universe when you control yourself, which is what we keep studying, that one common vital principle pervades all things, controllable by perfected human will. Because every organ in man is related to cosmic forces. Crosby says that in the law of correspondences. The senses in man corresponds to certain powers. So this was a very awful, profound science. How to purify oneself such that through this purification and working upon those centers in yourself which corresponds to cosmic centers, you can bring about changes. Some scholars say Hermes was called thrice great, right? Hermes Trismegistus. He was called as triple great because he taught students of the triple knowledge: astrology, alchemy, theurgy. If you look at its true meaning, it refers to this process. What is alchemy? The alchemist said that the lead or a base metal can be transmuted into gold through some processes. They were actually meaning that the lead corresponds to your lower nature, gold corresponds to your spiritual nature. So your lower nature can be purified and transmuted to become one with the higher through yoga. That is alchemy, the first. And then comes astrology. What is astrology? Not the stupid astrology that we find today, foolish. When will I get married? When will I get my new job, promotion? Not that at all. Every seven in man is connected with every seven in nature. There are seven heavenly planetary bodies which are directly connected with humanity, connected with man. So this connection between man and the heavenly bodies, what do we mean by heavenly bodies? Those round balls which run around the sun. No, there are intelligent hierarchy of beings, intelligences, which preside over each of these heavenly bodies, planets. Man has connection with them. So this knowledge was true astrology. And when you have perfected in alchemy in its true sense and astrology, then comes theurgy, which is magic as an art. Using these correspondences, putting it into practice, and there is no other god higher than you. Once this is understood in its entirety, man is the supreme power in the universe. There is no veil in nature. Nothing that man cannot know, nothing that man cannot do. That is the amount of power that each one of us is invested with. So the septenary nature of man and the unity in the septenary and the law of correspondences, this appears to be very important for us to understand. The unity in diversity, that is the one in the seven. You cannot study the seven as separate things. And each of these is connected with all the other sevens in nature. What is that correspondence? What is that knowledge? It is actually practical magic. Some hints are given in ST and so on. So, this is the thing, this is law of analogy and correspondence. So, we can take up any questions.